This is recorded in the office of Dean Coles on the morning of July 20th, 1970. The interview is between Dean Coles and Professor R.B. Eccles, Department of History. The interview is to be used by the Purdue University Archives. Dean Coles, suppose we start out with the first and obvious question. Will you tell us where you were born, give in your elementary, high school education, and your collegiate education up to the time you got your Doctor of Philosophy?
Well, I was born in Kentland, Indiana, which is a small town up here, about 85 miles south of Chicago. My childhood was on a general farm. It was in the Depression, and my folks and grandparents all lived together on the farm. I got my education in the Kentland school system. High school, about 100 people. I came to Purdue. I'm the only member of our family who's ever come to college.
Why did you select Purdue?
Oh, well, that was automatic. My grandfather was an outstanding corn breeder in this state. He was president of the Indiana Corn Growers Association. He never had a college education himself, but he had come to Purdue short course way back in the dim past. He had been an instructor here at Purdue back in the days in which they utilized these kinds of things. He knew Dean Fisher and Dean Skinner and Professor Wianco and Keller Beeson and all of these people in the Purdue's history of the 30s, and there was just no question where I was to come to school. In fact, it was never even discussed like we do nowadays. I have my own son we've been discussing, but Purdue was it. I was to come to the School of Agriculture. I initially thought I was going to be a VOAG teacher because this was about the only...
You mean vocational agriculture?
Vocational agriculture teacher, because this was about the only professional occupation which one envisioned a trained person in agriculture to have when I got here, which I came in 39. I soon changed my mind and decided I wanted to pursue agricultural economics. And I think this was largely because of there was quite a stimulating cadre of teachers in those days. Earl Butts, who later became dean, was a teacher of prices. Tom Cowden, who left here to become dean at Michigan State and then is now in the secretary's office, taught marketing. Doc Young, who went on to the graduate school, taught farm management. And this was kind of a golden age of those people, and they intrigued me. I was in the first class, which hurried up. Pearl Harbor caught us, you know. And I stayed on that summer and graduated in December of 42. Then went immediately, I was in advanced military, and went immediately then to Fort Sill, where I took my training and was commissioned in...
Learned to become a gunner.
And become a gunner, field artillery. Joined the 75th Division. Then, however, I got on another track and went to the Military Intelligence School in Maryland, where I first was a German military order of battle trained, and then became a MAP thing, and then finally ended up teaching in the intelligence school on the politics and maps of the Far East, which is a twist. And that's where I went. I finally, when I went overseas, I went into the Southeastern Theater and then spent about a year as head of the military intelligence operation of the Philippine Islands and those islands south of it, except Luzon. All this time, I had persuaded I wanted to go back to graduate school.
Are you a MacArthur boy?
I am not.
You'd say no more.
No, but of course, to my level, which was a captain, I never really knew too much except the general image of MacArthur in those days didn't attract many people that I was associated with, nor did it make a great deal of sense. I was very closely involved in much of the civilian reconstruction of the Philippines, and there was a lot of myth in that man's name. I'd always decided I'd wanted to go back to graduate school. I had married in the meantime. I had, during my undergraduate days, had worked through college and was an NYA student. You know, that's the
similar National Youth Administration.
That's right. Counterpart to our present, what do we call it now, where we have these for the people who want to work.
And Job Corps?
No, here at this university, you know what we have now. And I had worked for Dr. Ed Madsen and become very closely associated with him as an undergraduate, and during the war he had left to Missouri. And Earl now was head of the department, Earl Butts. And however, before I came back, Irene, my wife, had been down and looked for a place to live and so forth, but we decided that perhaps that I would be better off to make a change of schools. And so I followed my supervising professor, Dr. Madsen, to Missouri. And immediately got out of the Army and immediately entered graduate school in the University of Missouri.
Columbia.
Got my master's, taught there a year or so as an instructor in prices, an instructor in marketing. To show you how thin those days were in some of our staffs, I had only a master's and was working on my doctorate, but I also taught graduate work, and in that course at that time I had the future head of the Department of Agriculture Economics at Missouri, and Elmer Keel, who's dean of agriculture at Missouri now, was a member of my class at that time. It was kind of skinny in the staffs in those days. Earl Butts' siren song swung out, and Missouri was on the make. I mean, Purdue was on the make. Seemed to be getting off the ground much faster in those post-war days, and I came back. We rode the Wabash Cannonball back from Missouri one time, and Irene and I sat in the office, and Earl offered me an instructorship. And so we decided to come back, and we returned in the summer of 48. I became an instructor in marketing and pursued my research work and doctoral work at the same time. I brought quite a bit back, got my doctorate in 1950.
2 years, that's right. Either you worked very hard or you had done a lot on your master's. That's unusual.
Yeah, I had done quite a bit. Yeah. I brought a great deal of coursework with me. And I took the permitted 6 hours and snuck 3 hours in, well, extra in, usually in those days, by taking the courses by examination and things of this sort.
What was the final title of your doctor's thesis?
My doctoral thesis was a study of the supply response of agricultural products to prices, and I worked under Don Parlberg, who, as you know, later has become our distinguished professor in agriculture economics and has been in the secretary's office and in the president's office in Eisenhower administration, is now back in the secretary's office now. Don was a tremendous teacher. He's one of those people that had, and I suppose did a lot for me, both he and Earl, had that facility, who always said, you're supposed to communicate not just with your peers, but you're supposed to communicate with the public. And I suppose this is the big difference in my attitude and training to a lot of the newer ones, because this was thoroughly ingrained when I came back. The first thing Earl did was force me out on the banquet circuit. He said, it's the best experience you can get, and I talked in Lions clubs and Kiwanis clubs around here. I had a famous speech which was called The Loaf of Bread, which I talked about the cost of marketing products and who got what and so forth. That graduate class was a rather phenomenal class that I come back here with. Cliff Cox is now vice president of Armour. Charlie French is head of the Agriculture Economics Department here. John Hicks is executive assistant to our president here at Purdue. Another man, Rex Ranberg, went on to be head of the Department of Colorado. Ray Wilson is my associate director of the experiment station. That group that gathered right after the war, I don't think they were any smarter, but the opportunities were going to move up much faster in that sense. Decided to stay on at Purdue. It was an interesting decision. I had an offer from VPI to go over there. The offer was much higher at Purdue. My assistant professor's offer here in 1950 was $4,200. And I thought that was kind of niggardly. That was a 12-month basis and was below the going rate. But at that time, Earl Butts and Doc Young, both in their wisdom, said, you don't look at the first salary, you look at the potential. And I have never been, I have never regretted that particular decision. I think they were absolutely right. In fact, that's an administrative philosophy which I kind of remember, and I always argue that we shouldn't have to buy young assistant professors if we are as good as we think we are. That we should be able to buy, we should be able to get the best in assistant professors, at least at the market or a little less. This is hard economics if you want to talk about that way, if we're as good as we think we are, because they should have a greater future with us. Anyway, then I stayed. I taught marketing, beginning marketing, for my first love. Well, it's interesting, just to show you how universities work. When I decided to stay in 1950, my wife and I talked about it a long time. Was there going to be any room here? Because the department at that time was made up of outstanding people all in their 30s. There was Don Paarlberg, there was Burt Wood, there was Lowell Hardin. There was Earl Butts.
Norris Pritchard.
There was Norris Pritchard, yes, Norris. I mean, they were all there, and gosh, it looked like the slots were sure blocked. But within a year or two after that, Burt Wood had left to become head of the department in Oregon. Don Paarlberg was going to be called to work in the secretary's office. Earl Butts was going to go off, and Lowell Hardin was going to move to the head. And then I had the opportunity to teach prices, which was Don's course. It showed again the thinness of the staff. When Don was called to Washington in December, Earl called in and said, can you take the prices course next term? Well, in this day and age, there would be quite a debate over whether this was part of your load or not, and all of this, but to me this was such an opportunity. That term, I taught 15 hours because I wanted that particular opportunity. Well, I kept prices. I kept beginning marketing. I taught, I suppose, 70% of the students in agriculture from 1950 to 1965 had Coles somehow or other. Tremendous opportunity.
And from that time, you moved up the ladder to become full professor. Any other title along with it? Between 50 and 65?
No.
Just humble professor.
Yes, supreme professor. I'd always said at that time my goal was to be an overpaid, eccentric professor.
All right, now what happened in 65?
Well, in 1965, the sabbatic system had been here, and I'd never taken a sabbatic. I had taken a couple short leaves. I had taught at Northwestern during the summer. And I had taught with the clergy workshops at various places, economics, this kind of thing, but I'd never taken a leave. And I was invited to give a paper at the International Conference in France. So I decided that this was the time to take my sabbatic. So we took a 8-month sabbatic in Europe, and I taught at the University of Exeter in England.
Down Devons or what?
Yes.
Very nice there.
Tremendous.
Were you there in the strawberries and cream season?
But I was there in the Devonshire cream season, of course. The strawberries weren't quite that time. But that thick Devonshire cream, yeah. And all of that. But it's tremendous. I had debated before I went whether to go to Oxford or Cambridge, which had been kind of the traditional centers for our people. But we decided we wanted to see what this so-called red brick operation was, and beside that I wanted to be out where I wasn't with just another American colony. And I was the only American professor, of course, at Exeter. Tremendous experience. In the meantime, and when I came back with no other real intent, frankly, I had never, I have been a man without much planned goals. I mean, people are always talking, you should know where you're going, but I'd have to say very frankly, I've always liked what I've done and taken the opportunities that came.
Well, since in a full professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University, you weren't exactly in a horrible situation.
Oh, goodness, no, I had the best of all worlds, and I enjoyed it tremendously. I was well paid, I had a good teaching load, and I liked to teach, and I could always attract graduate students, but I never took more than four at any one time. And I just enjoyed my work. But the semester that I come back was the semester that Dr. Lowell Hardin, who was head of the Department of Agricultural Economics, had been ahead since Earl had become dean, Earl Butts, decided he wanted to take a leave to go to the Ford Foundation to work in their international area. And so Charlie French became acting head, and Charlie asked me to move over and act as his assistant head, which I did. Planning to move back when Lowell came back. Then Lowell Hardin decided to stay on. Charlie French was made the head of the department. And at that time, Paul Chena, who was the academic vice president, who had never had any sort of aide or anything, decided he wanted an aide. And Dr. Earl Butts suggested to him that I might be a good man. So I went over half-time to the executive vice president's office and in a setup kind of similar to what we've used in the graduate school, you know, where E.C. Young had developed the system wherein he took two or three people on a three-year term half-time. I continued to teach 9 hours a semester because I was sneaking enough, I didn't want to really give up my courses to somebody else with the idea that in a year or so I might be back, and then I could give back, and I treasured those courses. And I worked with Paul Chena. My first job was to study the organization of the Extension Service. That was a job the president assigned me, whether or not we should unify cooperative extension and university extension, and if so, how should we go about it. That was really a tremendous opportunity. I got around the campus a great deal, made my report. The essence of my report was that we should unify them whenever the university decided in honesty it wanted to have a full-fledged extension service and was willing to put some money where its mouth was. But until that occurred, if we unified them, all that we would do would be to bleed the Cooperative Extension Service in order to support the University Extension Service. That's still my opinion, and because the university's never either had the funds or seen fit to do the other, the report never got activated one way or the other. Dr. Chena was a tremendous man to work for. I don't know how one could have had or given year, a fledgling man looking at the university from the top could have had a more perceptive and exciting man to work for. He just assigned you a task and let you do it, but boy, he could ask the hard questions. He was pretty frank. I didn't always agree with him. I thought Sometimes he had a rather myopic view of some things. But a man of tremendous capacity and tremendous honesty, I think, when I viewed it. Then he left, as you know, to become director of research at General
director
Motors, I guess.
For
now
General
he's
Motors.
Now he's vice president for research, I guess. And they asked Dean Hawkins to become academic vice president. Well, this left Coles in a rather interesting spot, who had been a self-selected assistant to the previous one. Would I want to carry on? Would I be wanted to carry on? And what would the score be? Because I hadn't really had my full training in 1 year. I thought that would be kind of wasted. So I remember I just said there was only one way to solve that. And I went to Dean Hawkins, where I went over and introduced myself. We had known each other just passingly as one does in academic community. Said I'd like to continue to help him if he wanted me. And George said that would be fine. So I then had another year by an entirely different personality, a man who has, in many ways, his own peculiar set of tremendous assets, who'd been dean of engineering for a long, long time. And under Dr. Hawkins, I had a tremendous experience at that time, which I suppose gave me as much insight to university as anybody except the president and his administration. Dr. Hawkins was new, and therefore he visited every department on this campus within the first 3 or 4 months of his tenure, and I went along. And that was a tremendous experience. You can see the diversity of a big university. You can see that a university in many ways is a mirror of personalities at various levels. You can see also that a university administration has its own variation of competencies in it. I mean, we have a relationship, different competencies that seek their levels. But it was a tremendous experience. And in my year with George, I did many studies.
What was your title? Assistant to
assistant
the Vice
to the
President
academic,
of Academic Affairs.
Right.
All right.
I had the opportunity of attending the Dean's meeting during that year and President's staff meetings and got to know Dr. Prehaver. And so, sidelight, one of the interesting chores I had was to revise the university code. This had been Paul Cheney's cross that he had borne for years. Our code, as you recognize, is a mess. It had been kind of added to, and Nelson Parkhurst's office had been kind of assembled the job of keeping it in shape. But our code was a volume of, it was two or three volumes of 3 or so inches thick, but it was just a mess. And one of Paul Cheney's goals was to redo the code, reduce it by about 70%, and get it into some sort of readable fashion which would make sense to run the university. And he just said, okay, you take that, and you get the essence of that, and you write what you think should be the code. And we'll just start from there, and then we'll get that approved from scratch. Well, I took that. It was a tremendous experience. Frustrating. Our code, even now, is a combination of, it's a constitution, it's a bylaws, it's operating procedures, and back in Eliot's day, of course, the code incorporated all sorts of operational things.
Actually, under President Eliot, you didn't need a code, you needed Eliot, and then he told you what to do.
Well, apparently
there was
so.
There was another man in there, too.
Yeah.
And Stewart.
But apparently, when they decided they wanted it, put something, and they got the faculty council or whatever to ratify it, and it went into the code. But
did Hubby get Cheney on this? Is this revision of the code Hubby's doing?
I don't think I can answer that, Bob. All I know it was an overriding trauma of Paul Cheney that this university operated under such a mess from the viewpoint of code. Now, who started it, I don't know. He himself wrote the one section which is now written, which is attached to the, which incorporated the enabling legislation for the Senate. You know, there is one section of the code. Well, he wrote that.
Well, of course, actually, I can see why he's bothered, because as I talk to people and look back, this 25-year period of Hovde's administration is where Purdue changed from the small, efficient mechanical and agricultural and engineering college out in the tall corn to an international, huge university.
Run quite differently. Apparently, Eliot was an autocrat from the word go, up to where the image might have carried, but by the time I went to that office, anybody who thought the president was an autocrat, this was an external fiction, really, as he floundered around among all of the
mishmash. But actually, Hovde has changed this university, and I presume the code has to reflect this change.
And of course, the most interesting things remain, and still do, which shows, as a historian, you'd be interested, the capture we are of our own history. For example, when I looked into this, our vice president and treasurer is head of the residence hall.
That's right. This is unique.
Yeah, and this is apparently goes back to R.B. Stewart and something that he had and some personality issue or something in the past.
No,
I don't know what
it was. I can tell you, Stewart said this: if we have to spend money, the money is going to be spent and administered by one man who will have the responsibility. So if I goof, Stewart told me this, if I goof, it's my fault. But this is unique.
Yes. And of course, the union is in there too.
That's unique.
And so we're, and as I looked at this code, and we still are, we're faced with a very unusual, and in my opinion, and many times, if the personalities weren't right, an untenable situation. Now, of course, the personalities learn to adjust, wherein you have the control of a union and the student services of the living aspects of the student body, while the control of the operating aspects of the student body is in the Dean of Men's office, and therefore students looking forward see a two-headed situation. And I think we reap a little of this, and it's because I think, frankly, that Dean Roberts and Smalley, and they get along pretty well together, but it's a very unique thing. Anyway, the code was just full of all sorts of these things, and the code was full of things which have been repealed. For example, in my own area now, the law gives us an advisory commission, which was in the code. The law since has been changed because many of the organizations are out of business, but it was still in the code. Well, I rewrote the code. I, to make a long story short, I rewrote it. Oh, it was quite a masterpiece, and I got it in one folder, and 70 pages. I mean, it was. And so it was distributed to the administrative offices: Lytle, Vice President, Treasurer, Mallett. And of course, I took Dr. Cheney literally. He said, make sense out of the thing, and then we will fuss. Well, even Paul hadn't read his colleagues right, because when they started to read a revised code, which was put in languages, which was pretty clear, and started to clean up all the various other things, oh, we had a hassle.
You didn't allow enough gray areas.
We didn't. I learned my first lesson in that score. Anyway, I'll always remember as a personal incident to Lytle Freehaver. I had heard the rumor that Lytle had said that, well, I didn't know what it was, but I was trying to cut him out of his authority in the halls. So this for a young administrator, I use the word loosely, but for a new administrator, was a pretty disastrous hall rumor. And so I remember I went down to Lytle and I sat across from him and I said, What way this organization occurs is your business. Now, I was told to write it the way it made me it look sense. Now, whether you continue this way or that is no skin off of my back, and I don't want any of these damn tails running around these halls. And at that instant of time, from my viewpoint, I learned to appreciate Vice President Freehaver and have grown to respect him. He's a I mean, but at that confrontation of a young person insisting that he be told directly and honestly, from then on, I think we have had a tremendous relationship, and I have a tremendous respect for that. But long story short, the code never got off the ground. That way of doing it simply didn't work. Frankly, I don't know where we are now. I think the last man they had in was given the job again. Malone, who came in, I think he was supposed to do some work on the code. I presume this will be the cause celebrare for years.
However, you got up this far, and then did your title change? What happened when you were through being assistant to Vice President of Academic Affairs? Did you become dean then?
Yes.
You succeeded Dean Volk.
That's right. After 2 years at that spot, in which I had been a half-time professor and a half-time administrator, I had made up my mind that this was a role that no man should play. He either devoted his entire energies and intellect to administrative leadership, of which I am a believer in, not just a runner of committees, or he went back and devoted his full intellect and professional vigor to the classroom and the research, because I was doing a miserable, I could watch myself slip. I had a very unique opportunity. We'd made up my mind. I had, in the month of February, I was considered for an academic vice presidency at one coastal university and a presidency of a very small college to the north of us. And at the same time, then Earl had resigned to run for governor, and they were searching for a dean. So I had the unique opportunity, which doesn't happen to many men, I am sure, that during the month of March, I had the opportunity to weigh three routes.
What year was this? March what?
It's just, it's gonna be what, 68?
68, I would guess.
68. 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
I've been in the dean now 2 years next month. Yeah.
Right.
But not many people, you know, get a chance, I think. I think everybody always wishes, well, I wish that had been up. But I had that unique opportunity. Called on old Doc Young, which showed his tremendous wisdom again. Doc wouldn't say a thing. He just asked some questions. I talked to a lot of people, and to make a long story short, I decided that I would like to run what I consider one of the eminent agricultural establishments in a big university.
Well, while we're at this now, compare Purdue with other ag schools nationally and in the Big Ten.
Well, I think in honesty, we would say that if you were to list the five outstanding ag schools in all areas, we'll be among them.
What would be the other four?
Well, your list will vary a little, but it will include Iowa State, it will include California, it will include probably Cornell. This one has come and gone, but I think it must include Cornell over the time. It will probably include, and here you take your pick, ranging from Minnesota, Wisconsin, or Michigan State, or North Carolina. I mean, this covey. As a school, we range between 3 and 4 in size of enrollment, which is quite a compliment to us. We're not a big state by most definition. Our experiment station is one of the larger ones. And again, this is not because of federal state appropriation, but this has been because of the way in which its staff has pursued its resources. And our extension service is outstanding. As a graduate school, one doesn't treat a college as a unit. When you get into this area, some of your departments are stronger than others.
And will shift with personnel.
Time and personnel.
But you still, you would put us in one of the top three.
That's correct. I think there's no doubt about this. So when I looked upon this, and after all, the budget and the faculty and so forth of this school was a little bigger than the university that I was considering to be president of, And so I made my choice, and I've never regretted it. Of course, I've always made a habit of never looking back. But never regretted it. It's been a great feeling to have those opportunities, but I made the right decision.
Well, now let me ask you something. Generally, now that you're a dean, you look back over this. There was a great change after World War II in almost every area of university interest, research, and teaching. There's got to be a pattern of change or pattern of growth. What do you see it in agriculture after World War II, between World War II and now?
Well, I'd make one generalization on the curricular side. The pattern of growth was a switch from a vocationally oriented operation to a professionally concept of the agricultural disciplines. And this pervaded us. We have had two big curricular battles in this time. The biggest one was in the mid-50s.
Was this in the undergraduate or graduate
level? This was in the undergraduate.
And Dean Freeman wrote it out beautifully, I'll bet.
Yes. I can still remember those faculty meetings over here in Old Ag Hall, because what we were doing was we were going to require 12 hours of 15 hours of communication, speech and English and language.
You mean where the farmer can sit down and write a letter?
And this was a battle, I'll tell you. This was the dying gas between the vocational group and the basic professionalist group. That pendulum.
Well, there will be some changes in the future. What do you envisage for the future?
I envisage that the mainstream will stay on this kind of broad educational background. But there's going to be a secondary stream which we've got to come to grips with, and that whether it will take the form of two-year programs or whether it'll take the form of a technology program.
I'm
going
to say this is going to be ag technology.
That's right, because we've gone just a little too far in the idea that everybody is prepared with the assumption that he's going to become a PhD candidate. I mean, this is too far. We're recognizing it. And our students revolt against this. This, I think, frankly, is part of our student problem. We cease to treat them as if they were here for their own purposes, in many ways, and tried to mold them into what we thought they wanted to become in our image. And I think we're at the peak of this, and I think the next 10 years in a complex like this, we'll see, and of course this has always been the glory of agriculture in many ways. We've always been able to have a couple streams going without this awful concept of second-class citizens, which bothers a lot of the rest of the university. You see, when technology broke off from engineering, that would have never have happened here. When the School of Technology, our faculty would have said, okay, we got to encompass this. For example, right now we have two streams in ag engineering. We have an ag mechanization stream and a regular professional ag engineering stream. One is for that student who is a little more vocationally oriented, who just doesn't quite...
In other words, he wants to use his hands first.
That's right, and he has a good mind, but he wants to be more closer to the process. And we've always carried these multiple streams, and I think this is a glory of our staff, and it takes working. I mean, this is a difficult challenge. Well, that's one. In the research station, the change has been fundamentally from dealing with the highly applied work of the farm itself to moving back a step or two to feeding research work into the growing industrial complex, which does the applied work. Now, this hasn't been easy, and it still dogs us. For example, most ag schools, and we are one, have always been heavily involved in breeding programs in the plant field. We hybrid corn was an output of the college system. All the wheats that are grown in Indiana now are really, really the long shadow of Professor Caldwell and others in our... Now, as time has gone on, we've now developed a very large and powerful complex of plant organizations, seed companies, who take and develop their own patented strains. So we've got to find our role back one step from that actual into this more
into pure research,
into more fundamental kinds of research that go on in plant breeding and whatnot. This gives us problems, and an experiment station is always going to have to carry water on both shoulders, because we were put in place to solve problems. And I've always argued with my faculty, I always want to be able to answer positively the question from our supporters, what did you do for me today? We always should have something. But any good research station which is going to answer that question today has got to have behind it an ongoing body of more fundamental work. And this is our aim. Here again, we haven't, but I think here the experiment station idea academically fell into somewhat disrepute, as you might know, in the 50s and 60s with the NSF and others who gave grants to individuals. In other words, there was the great outgrowth of professional grants. I think frankly now they recognize that any scientist should always have the discipline of somebody saying to him, what did you do today? There should always be a little of this involved. In the Extension Service, the same changes have taken place. Our Extension people used to help people call hens, used to help people eliminate barberry bushes, practice. Now our service has turned into more of a continuing education service in helping our farm community, our rural community, and our agricultural business connect to the latest findings, and this has been our change.
In other words, you don't show them how to do it, but you say, look, if you will adopt this system or this practice, this is what might result.
I think one of our most interesting things, which I think illustrates tomorrow, we have what we call a top farmer workshop. And this brings together the scientists in animal science, in agronomy, botany, ag engineering, and ag economics, who come together, and they bring these people in for a week here now, which would be an unheard of thing in the past. And they utilize the computer and they place into this management complex all that is known about modern technology of a farm, and they make these farmers play the management game into the future as an educational tool. Well, you couldn't have operated that way 10 years ago, even now.
I remember 30, 40 years ago, that was people objecting to the Nebraska agricultural schools, telling them how to do contour plowing on the grounds we've been plowing this way for 30 years. What about a bunch of professors who, with their feet on the desk, know about it? That's all gone, though, isn't it?
Not all, but most.
Pretty well.
We find you always have to have somebody out there to answer, what do I do with my rose bush if you want that county to support
yes.
you?
All right.
Because you recognize our extension service is one of those unique things in which gets direct support from a county, the county commissioners pass a budget, the state passes a budget, and the federal passes a budget. And when students are in here asking me whether I'm relevant, I say, boy, when you serve people who pass on your money, you stay pretty relevant.
Let me ask you, in this, has the undergraduate, we mentioned it, but we got off that for a second. I just want to clear it up for the tape. The undergraduate curriculum, has it changed since you talked about the great shift in the 50s?
Yes, we just had a new revision last year. Again, this one last year was to make us a little bit more flexible, because I think it's useful to look at agriculture as a small college if you want. I've got landscape architects who are design-oriented and are just as liberal-arty as you go. I got food scientists who are just as hard science-oriented and chemistry and whatnot. I've got economists who are social scientists, and then I've got the intervening groups. And what we're having to recognize is that our old idea that everybody used to have in our school 12 hours of chemistry. Everybody. Well, that doesn't make much sense for these others. And so our last curricula revision, they wouldn't give up the science, but they said the science block will be 12 hours, of which 3 must be chemistry. You choose the rest. Okay, that makes the landscape architects, so they'll take geology. But I mean, we went this route last time.
It's probably intelligent in the necessity today to build up some broad, basic concepts of whatever area you are in. I can see that. We tried to do that, in my school. Has there been any great change in the PhD curriculum, graduate program?
Yeah, I suppose there has. After all, Dr. Butts, you know, was the first doctorate in economics out of Purdue. And he got his in, what, 37, 38?
He didn't get it in the economics department, but he got it in ag.
Ag econ, he was the first one.
Yeah.
And even in order to get that, he had to go spend a semester in Chicago. Now you can see then, okay, that's 30 years ago. We're from that start. Now to where in our graduate enrollment is around 700, thereabouts, 700 or 800. About half of them are PhDs.
This is where you say we've changed from a technological school to a research-oriented graduate program. Now, let me ask you the next one. What about the changes within the departments? For example, didn't we have a tremendous battle when we took zoology and botany and put it together, and you ended up finally in some sort of a science?
Yeah. Now that was Dr. Butts, and I imagine he talked a little about that. But I think his great plan was really to have as few departments as possible. Probably an animal science department, a plant science department, and an economics thrust of some kind. Even as it is, we have fewer departments than almost any ag school in the country.
That is, now but, you have, a, what about the science building? Isn't that a symbol of it?
Yeah, kind of, the animal, the life science
life
building.
Science.
That was part of the symbol. See what we took, he took dairy husbandry, animal husbandry, poultry husbandry, and combined them into an animal science department.
Did this cause a lot of head shakings and furor?
Yep, it sure did. It was an amazing thing. It was done. Had a masterpiece involved, of course, you utilize again those instances of history. And he had three heads that were awful close to retirement about the same time. Otherwise, it had been very difficult. Dr. Martin, who had headed a poultry for a long time. Dr. Harper, who had headed animal science for a long time. And Gregory, I think. But anyway, they were all coming up. So he reached into the hopper and picked up young Dr. Fred Andrews, who is now our vice president for research, and said, "You're to head that new aggregation." And it was a correct move, but I don't think that you should ever get carried away. The merging of three groups of people does not automatically make a single group. We are more and more combined with each passing day, but we will not be a single department in full philosophy until we work through a whole generation of faculty in many ways. Now, interestingly enough, the plant sciences look like a disagreement with this philosophy, because we have agronomy, botany and plant pathology, and hort. Mm-hmm. When I became dean, well, let's put it that way, back under Dr. Butz's thought, he had a resignation in the part of a botany head and also in the part of a hort head. And so he thought he was going to move into gear to make a plant science. But just to show you how fast academia moves, he made that first move with animal sciences, and I'd have to go back and look, but maybe you're know by now, but I would presume in 62 or something of that sort. Now we're up to about 67. And in that 5 years, academia had changed so dramatically. In 62, he made it from this office by fiat. By the time you got to 67, this kind of movement was no longer feasible in academia. You had to have some faculty input. And he created a committee which broke right down the middle, which is, I guess, standard. So that stayed apart, and then when I became dean, I also had a botany head to choose pretty quickly, and I asked the same question again among my faculty. And I guess I take a slightly different look. I argue that a department in a professional school like ours, which may be somewhat different than yours, a department is an administrative structure, which encompasses several disciplines, really. Because an animal science department has physiologists, geneticists, nutritionists. I mean, these are the disciplines. It's a focus. Its main job is personnel management. And that means it can get too big as well as too small. Because as I look upon the faculty, they want direct access to the one man who is directly over them. In other words, the open door of the head, in my opinion, is one of the primary perquisites of a good department head. And if he has to go to assistant head or a second assistant head, the thing begins to get under pretty great strain. Okay, all of my departments now, I think, are right. They got 40 and 50 and 60 professionals in them. And they got budgets that run over $1 million. Well, this is... If I'd have combined the plant departments, I would have had a department of almost 150 professionals. Mm-hmm. And a budget of somewhere near $3 million, which would have made it bigger than the chemistry aggregation by a long way. And beside then, from the sheer faculty difficulties in finding this thing, I think it didn't make administrative sense. So I backed away. Will we have new departments in the future? I suspect.
Now, while we're on the faculty, what about your changes in faculty government, both in the school and in the university?
Well, you know, I had the unique opportunity of being chairman of that committee, which brought the Faculty Senate into being. That was a learning experience.
Yes.
That was 64, I think. Think that
you see, the executive council was all right, but I remember a man over in Cranick who resigned from it. because he said the day he came in and the executive committee was told, or the council was told, what had been done, he resigned. He said, as I understand it, we were to discuss this and decide here, and it's been decided for us. And the answer was, that's right, that's the way we do things at Purdue. The executives tell you what to do and tolerate faculty opinion. And well, he resigned.
Well, I think that becomes part of the history. And then, as you know as well as I do, there about 2 or 3 years before we had our real change, as the faculty began to grow in its feeling of need to have some output, what we'd have would we have the executive council meet and pass something. Then you remember they all had to go to the faculty meeting. Then you were meeting time after time when the faculty would overturn the executive council. You remember this, and it got to be really where we were governmentless. I mean, in many ways. So the president appointed a committee to study the problem of faculty government. And why he asked me to be president, chairman, I'll never know. In fact, when I heard it, I was so damn mad, I stormed into my head, and I said, he hasn't even called me. But my head at that time, a little hardened, persuaded me that this might be an important chore. So I worked with the president. But I'll tell you, Professor Eccles, that was a learning experience. We were ripe. In other words, as you remember, we were next to chaos at that time. We were ripe for change. We were ripe for some kind of representative government. We were going to have a lot of trouble on giving any powers to the Senate from the faculty meeting, which had developed into kind of an open forum, as you recall. You used to attend and everybody had to speak their piece. But the committee did a good job, I think. It developed a Senate of a fixed number and certain recall procedures and things of this sort. I have no apologies for what was put on docket as the first approximation. I had to go department by department. I can still remember my meetings in physics, in chemistry, psychology, as I took the document around. I recall telling my wife that I thought we were all gentlemen, but I never really knew it until we got right down to the nitty-gritty.
Suddenly discovered that professors are not only human beings, but men of varied opinions.
Yeah, that's right, and they can be cruel when they want to be.
I have had little respect for this for a very interesting reason. I learned under Dean Ayers and under Dean Potter that the faculty may be considered, but unless you control it, what's the use of arguing? Now, the question I still think is, to what extent does the Purdue faculty control its destiny, or is it, in other words, do the deans and vice president work for the faculty, or do they represent the executives and the faculty in the end has to take the power? Under a man like Stuart, for example, you know where you stood. You didn't need to have a faculty meeting. You talked to him. Now, has this changed? Are we on the way now to where the faculty will dominate policy?
I hope not. When you use that word, I don't believe that any more than I believe that the administration should dominate policy.
You should think it would be a cooperative venture.
That is correct, and I know this is asking for maybe the impossible. But I think if you look upon, and this is always hard for me to do because of my basic biases, but if you look on the university's three parts, administration, faculty, and students, if you take the attitude that one part is going to dominate the other, in this day and age, all we got is one grand and glorious fight and chaos. I think what we are is that we're at a watershed in faculty government. I think we had to come a long way because I am sure in my mind, in my 20 years as faculty member, there was no doubt about who ran the university in the early days. No doubt about it. And I'm not arguing about it. I mean, it's true. There was no doubt about it that this was one of the things that gradually led to the complete chaos in the old faculty system and executive council, and we had to do something else. I think our last 5 or 6 years have been a period of growing pains, learning. If you want my frank opinion right now, I think one of the problems we are at now is that in its process to balance, the faculty has moved rapidly to wanting to have the final say in everything, and this is not going to be either operationally possible or legally possible. We've got to arrive, and I think we will, but we've got to arrive at some reasonable sense of trust among us all and some reasonable sense of whose job is to do what, and then review the job if you don't like it, but you can't run always by committee. Now, you ask what I view a role of the dean. I view a role of the dean as a leader of his faculty in the process of policy formation. I think he must represent to the president all of the things that a faculty has in its mind as best he can while we're arguing about what policy is. When that policy is made, that dean is also part of this administration.
He has to carry it out,
and he can't continue then to become the faculty maverick under these circumstances, but he can continue, I think, to continue to raise the questions that must be raised.
In other words, the problem becomes one of intelligent communication.
Oh, I think so. I simply do not. There are some deans and department heads who continually degrade themselves and saying, well, we're just chairman, we just... Frankly, somebody has to set an educational tone for an institution. And no institution is greater than its faculty, but a faculty can be greater than in some of its parts if the right tone is set and bring all those people to working together and thinking in terms of a whole. And here I think we failed a bit right now. I think we're kind of the watershed in this. I think we're probably at the right time to choose a new president, in many ways.
Yes. Are there any major problems that we've omitted in discussing? We've gone through your list that you had, and is there something you'd like to take off? You feel very strongly about something.
Yeah.
All right.
I feel very strongly that one of the big problems of academia that will be solved in the next 5, 7, 8 years is a realistic view of tenure. I'm a firm believer in the idea that there must be protection to the scientists.
After all,
I sit in a place in which I got to do this all the time. In other words, if one of my animal breeders says that Holsteins are better than Jerseys, I get a whole flock of Jersey breeders on my neck, and we're just one continual history of protecting the right of our scientists to pursue truth.
All right.
Now that's one thing. And I think tenure had a great deal of meaning as long as the faculty also thought they had a sense of ethics as to what their expertise was. But as soon as my animal science professor begins to talk about politics in his classroom, then he has no more expertise in that area than anybody else. And he should not have the protection of tenure to allow him to pursue anything he pleases. Now,
the dialogue that makes a university is the dialogue that a professor is not supposed to abuse in order to bring in his own personal opinions. He's there to have a dialogue on the subjects in which he is competent,
and to pursue truth as he sees it. And I'm awful willing to have a broad latitude here, but boy, when we begin to step out in various ways, we're going to have an awful time protecting this thing which is so important. So I believe one of the real problems is going to find some realistic view of tenure protection.
Well, of course, you realize you can't get that with 4/5 of the young PhDs coming out of universities today.
I guess you touched upon the thing which leads me to believe we got a long and turbulent decade ahead of us as we evolve modern education.
For example, I had an experience with some men in physics. I know nothing about physics, so I will not talk to them about it. Because, I mean, it's not my thing. But these gentlemen instruct me very carefully in the latest of ideas, all of which are merely hashed over Karl Marx. They have the slightest idea what they're talking about, and they're discovering the world. But if they do this in their class, is this a kind of problem that you are...
It sure is. In other words, I have no... If a student wants to have a seminar of professors in the union, they can go over there and talk to their heart's content, communicate. But when they get to that classroom, and start to use that privileged era to manipulate young minds in things in which they have no expertise, I think we're asking for it.
Well, we probably will get it.
Right.
Well, I think the universities have to reform and reshape themselves. The thing that always amazes me is how many of the alumni of an institution, supposedly educated men and women, show no signs of ever having been in a tolerant or in an atmosphere at all.
Very, very true. And of course, I deal with a clientele. I used to think we're as bad as worse, but I don't think they're much worse than others, really. They're just closer to me, just closer. The edge of agriculture touches its alumni closer than most other edges, I
yes,
think.
Yes, because they are constantly,
in touch
for information, in touch with the...
So I don't believe they are necessarily more ignorant or more conservative. We just hear them in louder and clearer voices. And this is sure true. We turn out people who missed the essence of the educational process of a university.
Well, then do you think this, in a sense, that the university has some measure, should have some measure of control over the faculty? What about the attitude? What you do is hire a good man in his field and let him go. In other words, we get a scientist, or we get an ag scientist, he may be a member of the president of the local Communist Party, but as long as he's the best man in this area, you let him alone.
I guess I don't really fully buy that. First place, I don't completely let him alone in the classroom. This is academic anarchy. If he is to teach a course which his colleague says has this bundle of information, and then the next step in the academic process is supposed to build on that, then he does not have complete freedom to do as he completely pleases in that bundle of hours without any relationship to the rest of his colleagues. That's not true. Otherwise, all he's doing is playing the student for a pawn. In other words, if History 1 is a prerequisite to History 2, and History 2 believes in the faculty meetings and so forth that this is covered in 1, but Professor X says, that isn't what I want to teach this semester, then 1, he should not have that right, and 2, he's played shenanigans both with his colleagues and his students, and that's not right. Secondly, I'm back again, he can be a Marxist, and if he wants to go over town, I think it shows poor judgment on his part, because no way can you divorce who you are. You're a professor, and in the minds of most people, that makes you a professor at Purdue, and it's very hard. We don't have a complete free other life, or I don't. But
and
again, that should be his right.
You still are a member of a community.
That's right, and should be his right, but not his right in his classroom or in his research class.
I think that's a pretty good division. Well, now, let's get on something personal. We will have a list for the tape, and this is just for the tape. We'll have a list of your publications and major speeches. Is there anything you'd like to talk about here or mention of which you're particularly proud?
Oh, I have the most widely used text of marketing in the country. It's been through three editions, and it's in the fourth. I've picked up a young man, Professor Downey, who's going to help me now, and gradually he'll take it over, I presume. I've been really proud of that. I have written 3 or 4 papers that I have been proud of, efficiency in marketing and so forth. I guess, and this sounds queer, I am really more proud of the writing I have done for the public press over my 20 years.
In what sense? In what area?
Well, I have written in Successful Farming, in all of the kinds of public presses that deal with our agricultural things, because I'm a great believer that that knowledge must be communicated, and I like it when a magazine who makes money says I can write for them. I've always felt rather pleased at this idea.
Good.
Not for the money, but I have spoken, of course, a lot. By both Earl's initial background and then the position I'm in, I tell my counties I'll come into you. I have 92 counties, and I try to get into them once every 3 years, which means just on an average I got 30
speeches a year
outside, just in this communicative device. In that sense, this office, I suspect, is unique among all the deanships of the campus.
Your public relations.
Yeah.
Well, now the list of your major speeches, addresses, and publications will be in the appendix. Now, you want to reminisce a little about some of the men under whom you've worked and with whom you've worked?
Oh. I suppose there are two or three. One is close to your knowledge, of course, and I always thought one of the finest minds that had an imprint on me was Dr. Estee.
J.A. Estee.
And here, in my opinion, was a classic professor in whom tenure had meaning. I always wanted to know where Estee stood, really, because he was one of those few people who could be almost a perfect eclectic. I took 6 weeks of Marx under him, I took 6 weeks of Keynes under him, and I always felt that he was presenting that package just as rigorously as he could, and I never really knew, and he always said, well, when you want to find that out, you come to my office, young man. Now, not many teachers can do that, but he was a tremendous...
Dr. Estee was, quite frankly, a conservative socialist, if such a thing is possible.
Is that right?
He believed, in other words, that society, that he believed in the socialist idea that everybody ought to be looked after. But he also, remember, he was a Canadian, believed that you ought to have a chance to, in the real old American sense, get ahead. But he did believe society was a unit.
But I'll have to say that when he went to his classroom and he taught Mill, or he taught others, he taught it with all the rigor that his intellect could
bring. You know, I visited those classes, and may I say I've known few people who had the wit and charm that he had. And frequently he was so funny that he talked over the heads of his students. Yes. But wasn't he a wonderful man?
He was tremendous. So there's certainly one, and I had a tremendous regard for him as both a person who I knew later.
What about your people like Reed and Young?
Well, of course...
I knew Young very well. I didn't know Reed at all.
Well, I knew Reed only in an indirect sense as a young faculty member knowing his dean. Reed was one of these brutally honest people. They tell the story of them, and I guess it's true, and that is when Dave Fendler was trying to break us out of our boxes, and he was telling them that if he left the curriculum solely in the departments, our boys would never get any more math or English or whatnot, and he wanted a general agriculture curriculum to act as a competitive weapon. And the vote was 8-1 in the department heads meeting against it. And Harry Reid, according to the story, looks at the heads and he said, I vote aye. Passed.
That was it.
But this was the kind of vigorous leadership, I think, which that time both used and knew, and he did a good job. Doc Young was one, again, he was an Estee-like person, tremendous tower of an intellect, a scholar, could move off in all sorts of directions, and really one of the greatest believers in individual integrity of any person I knew. I think the graduate school organization is an image of Doc Young, not many. let it so loose to start with, had a council transferring memberships. This was all Doc Young's image, and just not a very good undergraduate teacher. More of a character than a good undergraduate teacher.
But he had a searching, a questing mind.
He left his mark on people in that sense. Earl Butz was a tremendous teacher. He had that ability to make complex things lucid and simple. I think back to my undergraduate days, and one of the people that stands out in my mind was Charlie Murphy.
I'm glad you mentioned him.
He taught the history of the South when I was an undergraduate, and it was a very popular course. And I had to take back in those days, the ag curriculum was so restricted, I had to take all my liberal arts sub rosa. So I took a listener's in his, and I stood in the back end of a classroom over in the old recitation building to hear Charlie Murphy. I don't know enough about Charlie, but as a powerful teacher to get across a feel and a sense of excitement, he was his own kind. I said, a tremendous guy in that sense. I had a course under Enders as a young man.
That's Dean of the old School of Science.
That's right, the old Dean Enders of the School of Science lectured beginning biology in the old, what's now the main building for the humanities building. There used to be a big lecture room.
Stanley Cooler Hall. Yeah. It's still upstairs.
Is it? Poor Dean Enders never really recognized he was talking to freshmen. I mean, that I'm sure we saw a scholar at work, but he sure
talked over your head.
He sure was a misfit on that basis, but these are the kinds of people you think about. Norm Volk, as a directing scientist, left a tremendous impact on this station. Norm really believed, from the research view, of hiring people and letting and supporting them. And I think, back to your earlier question, I think this makes a lot more sense in research, maybe, than it does in the classroom, and that's what we're talking about. But he managed to, among my own colleagues now, and one you might want to take an oral history from, is J.B. Peterson, head of agronomy. Been head there for 20 years. What I would consider to be a real eminent administrator. If you judge administrators by the caliber of people that he surrounded himself with, Pete will get an A+. He has really assembled a stable. And of course, my fun time of academia has always been in arguing with J.B. Kohlmeyer, Carol Bottom, Noah Adley, and this group of rather rascally kind of scholars that operated in the academia of agriculture. These were the
anything more? Have we left out anything that ought to be in there?
I suppose, from the viewpoint of history, we've had an interesting movement in general in the perspective that bricks play in an academic institution. I started out in a room with three others when I was an assistant professor. Finally got up to two. Finally, after I'd been a full professor, got my own office in this old corn crib over here with no air conditioning and so forth. When they finally moved to Krannert, my goodness. Then I heard the story that some professor wouldn't go into a building because its office wasn't air conditioned. Well, I think this is fine. I don't argue that. I'd like to get all my professors that way. But I think we've developed over my now nearly 20 years as a professional, 25, we've developed an idea that bricks are the essence for somehow, and I use bricks now in the sense of all sorts of fancy equipment. Everything is the essence of university hardware. And I'm sure there's, it takes all of these, but I doubt whether they play as important part of a major university as we like to think they do. When the chips get down, if you got the right esprit de corps I guess I'd have one other thought, and this may end on a controversial note. I think Purdue has got to find its total mix. I think we're developing an unfortunate controversy now. We're developing a controversy among the professional schools against the humanities and social sciences, and even to some extent the basic sciences, as if they were protagonists. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. A good ag school requires a crackerjack humanities, liberal arts, history, whatnot. It requires them. I think one of the things we got to watch, though, is that it takes service from each of us. And as we have moved into trying to quote whatever it is, we use this term pursue excellence, which has lost its meaning to me.
Or uniqueness. We have a unique program at Purdue.
I find a harder and harder time supporting to my faculty the fact that we need a strong department and strong humanities and whatnot as an input, when the next statement they say, yeah, but the next thing they do is tell us that, they'll teach those sessions for their own kids, but not for us.
What you mean that a course in English is a course in English. There is no such thing as English for agriculture.
Oh, I believe firmly in this. One of the reasons that a professional school should send itself to the humanities and other schools is to become humane and to get mixed and to rub shoulders and to give advantage to that group of students also, that engineers and pharmacists and agricultural people are human beings with goals. And we haven't yet caught the university mission of this heartland. I mean, we've been so busy fighting to get ourselves up and all this business that we haven't caught that.
Well, it'll come. Let's hope.
Oh, I think so.
Anything more? No, all right, well then...
If I covered what you want, I don't know.
Well, I wanted to cover what you wanted. Yeah. Now, is there some... That's why I asked you if you have anything more to get off your chest. Now, if you want to say anything more, we'll come back and do another interview. If not...
Has it been worthwhile? I mean, is this the kind of stuff you deal with?
Yes. If not, we'll say that this is the end of an interview on July the 20th between Dean of Agriculture Richard Coles, Professor R.B. Eccles, Department of History, and it's for the use of the Purdue University Archives.